All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Dale Thronberry.
And welcome to Veterans Radio. My name is Dale Thronberry, Chief Warrant Officer, Helicopter Pilot in Vietnam, 1969. Welcome to our program. We're really excited to have you here today because our guest is going to be Dr. Rebecca Grant. And for those of you that have followed Veterans Radio over the years, this is our expert on foreign affairs and foreign policy for the United States. She's got many topics that she's going to address today. We're going to be talking, of course, about what happened in Afghanistan, how the Chinese and the Russians may want to try and move in. We're going to be talking about the end of the war or escalate dilemma, the whitewash of the Taliban, and the latest from Russia. You know, President Putin is self-quarantined himself. And of course, we always have to go back and take a look at Korea. And just this week, we're also going to be talking a little bit about what's going on in Australia. So I really encourage you to stick around. This is a great opportunity for you to learn the facts, the true facts. I think this is this woman is someone that I trust entirely. She's been involved with so many different things. She's a national security analyst in Washington. She's got her PhD in international relations from the London School of Economics. She worked at the RAND Corporation. She was on the staff of the Secretary of the Air Force and the Chief of Staff of the Air Force. She's involved with the Air Force Association. She has written over 100 articles for Air Force Magazine, and she regularly appears on the Smithsonian Channel, Fox News, CNN, and of course, here on Veterans Radio. But before I get to that interview, I've got to make sure that we thank our sponsors. We couldn't do this without their support and your support. So if you'd like to help out, please go to veteransradio.net, click on the Support Us button there, and click anything that you can do to help us out, because it does cost us a little money to be on our stations. And I should remind you that we are, not only are we on here in Ann Arbor, Michigan, we're also on WDTK in Detroit, Michigan, KMET out in California, KWOZ in Minnesota, and online, of course. So please, we greatly appreciate any help that you could offer us. Thank you. So here we go. I want to thank our loyal sponsors, Legal Help for Veterans, specializing in veterans' disability claims. Call Legal Help for Veterans at 800-693-4800. The National Veterans Business Development Council, better known as NVBDC, is the nation's leading third-party authority for the certification of veterans-owned business. If you want to do business with the government and you are veteran-owned, you need to get certified by NVBDC. Go to their website. That's nvbdc.org. The Eisenhower Center in Ann Arbor in Jacksonville, Florida, they specialize in the treatment for veterans, first responders, and athletes. Anyone suffering from post-traumatic stress, TBI, or a closed head injury, they have in-house treatment centers, and they also do outpatient treatment as well. For more information about the Eisenhower Center, go to their website. That's eisenhowercenter.com. U.S. Wings, the manufacturers and distributors of the finest leather jackets in the world. They also manufacture and sell all sorts of military paraphernalia. Go to uswings.com for more information. The Charles S. Kettles VA Medical Center here in Ann Arbor, Michigan, is a strong supporter of our program. We want to make sure that we thank our veteran service organizations here in the local Ann Arbor area. That's Vietnam Veterans of America, Charles S. Kettles Chapter 310, American Legion Post 46, and the VFW Post 423. Learn more about these organizations and the service they provide on our website at veteransradio.net/our sponsors. You can also find out what it would take for you to become a sponsor here on Veterans Radio. All right, so that's the business is out of the way. Let's get right into that interview. Here is Rebecca Grant. So we're back here now with Dr. Rebecca Grant. And as many of you listeners of Veterans Radio know, we've been talking with Dr. Grant for almost 10 years now. And she is a national security analyst based in Washington, D.C. She has a PhD in international relations from the London School of Economics. She worked at RAND. She founded IRIS, the independent research, which she specializes in research for government and aerospace industry, clients that range for analysis of military campaigns to projects on military technology and so forth. She's been seen on the Smithsonian Channel, Fox News, CNN, and of course, Veterans Radio. So I want to make sure that we welcome back Dr. Rebecca Grant.
Thank you, Dale. It's great to be talking with you again.
It is, and we have a lot of things to discuss today. The news is, as all of our listeners are aware of, probably have been focusing on the withdrawal from Afghanistan. So I guess we should probably go there first.
Yes, because the withdrawal from Afghanistan is going to be a stain on America's world reputation for decades, if not longer. I think as we start to step back from the chaos, a couple of things really strike me before we talk about some of the tactics and the strategy, Dale, and that is this really is regarded now by the Taliban as a victory for jihad. I mean, they'll be weaving the rugs and putting this into tapestries. And this Taliban is very media savvy. They have multiple spokesmen. They have a big social media and internet presence, and they've made the most of this, saying that things that you just cringe to hear. They talk about how never in a million years did we think we could defeat the mighty United States with just our rifles, and we've defeated them, and it must have been the will of Allah. The things that are so painful to hear, they have concocted this into a victory for the ages, as far as they're concerned. And why is that bad? And immediately, that will help them with their online recruiting and with their stature in that horrid, shadowy world of international terrorism. So the victory of jihad in Afghanistan, unbelievable, would never have seen it coming even as early as June and July of this year.
Well, one of the things that we've been having some questions about and talking with my veteran friends, of course, in my generation is that, you know, the comparison between the, leaving Vietnam and then, of course, leaving Afghanistan. And these hurt because the decisions to leave are not necessarily military. They're mostly political. And so many of these veterans now are kind of standing there going, well, what did I do and why did I do that? For if you guys were going to leave. And so I would like you to address that just briefly, if you could.
Yes, a congressman from Texas who had served, Representative Troy Nels, really put it well. He said, 20 years in Afghanistan, and we gave it back in 3 weeks. You know, Dale, over that 20-year period, 800,000 U.S. servicemen and women rotated through Afghanistan. And as you know, it was every branch of the military. Navy sent individual augmentees, obviously, of course, big mission for the Army, the Marines, the Air Force. 800,000 U.S. veterans went in and out of Afghanistan. And I think we're all wondering why did it go wrong right at the end? And, you know, that is a tragedy. But we have to, I think, acknowledge how painful this really was. I heard the comparisons with Vietnam and I shuddered, but then what we saw, I think, in many ways was so much worse, because this withdrawal from Kabul and the loss of Afghanistan and the democratically elected government, it really could have been pretty easily prevented, and I think that's made that even harder to put up with.
Well, how do you think that we could have prevented that? I mean, it seems like the government of Afghanistan was, you know, pretty much out of control or didn't have any control.
Right. Government of Afghanistan, not the best, had been difficult over the last couple of years during the negotiations with the Taliban. And you see a lot of commentary that says, well, Afghanistan was a problem for a long time. That's 100% true. Afghanistan was a big problem. Should we have done it differently from the start? Yes, absolutely. But make no mistake, this was really a problem that occurred from approximately mid-July until August 15th. And this is a period of time that all of this could have been avoided. And I have to say, we have to place the blame for this directly on the Biden administration team, because they were the ones in the job at that time. So to quickly roll back, the agreement signed in February 2020 with the Taliban was for a conditions-based withdrawal. What were the conditions? Well, there had to be no attacks on U.S. forces. There had to be discussions between the Afghan government and the Taliban. That's a part that never went very well. And our U.S. plans, right up through the end of July, called for actually leaving a small U.S. force presence in Afghanistan. So there are a number of opportunities here to treat this differently. Now, what had been the case for a long time, I mean, we know that the Taliban had control of about 50 to 60% of the territory of Afghanistan. That had actually been true for many years and was true during the time of the peace negotiations. But the real tragedy here was the failure of the United States to see and react to events on the ground. By early August, we also stopped giving air support to the Afghan National Security Forces, and that turned out to be a fatal problem. So there were many, and I know all of you listening in the audience, there are many, many tactical decision points where the wrong decision was made every time. But the point I'm making is that it would have been possible to say, hey, stop. This is not the terms of the peace deal, and we will leave U.S. forces here until we get the Afghan talks back on track or until the Taliban stops what they're doing. And at every point, those decisions weren't made. We really see a level of chaos, and General Mark Milley talks about no one thought it would fall in 11 days, but there was this inability to react to events on the ground that I think is really the long-lasting damage out of this situation.
Yeah, it's a terrible situation that they put all these veterans in, because again, you know, they're going to be questioning what were they doing and why did they do it, and we just want to make sure that we encourage them that you did the best that you can, that you could, and that all of this is not your fault. No, you can't take the blame for political decisions that are made outside of your control, because so many of them that I've talked to that were working with the civilians and trying to build the schools and trying to provide water and everything else that goes along with the infrastructure over there, and then everything is kind of yanked out from under them. And this is where the similarity comes in to the people that were left in Vietnam in 1975, and suddenly, the North Vietnamese came rolling in their tanks and everything, because we withdrew all of our air power and we withdrew, all of the support for the South Vietnamese army. And that's what so many people are dealing with. There are many discussion groups out there of veterans that are trying to rationalize and trying to, just figure it out. Why did they do these things, and how did the military get themselves in this situation? And the politicians, of course, and the lack of intelligence, it seems like, information that either people didn't pay attention to or just didn't understand it.
Yes, and on those lines, I'd say two things. First is, military members who served there, you did your job. The job was to keep America safe from 9/11 style attacks, and that worked. Mm-hmm. We have been safe from those, and God willing, we will be still. So those military members, you did your job there, and I think our country is very, very grateful to you for that. That job was accomplished. Your mission was successful. Secondly, I frame the blame for this as from July and August of this year, and that blame goes on the State Department. And the blame, I think, particularly goes to the Secretary of State, who is our leading official. I talked on CNN as this was happening, and I said, honestly, he should resign. Mm-hmm. Someone should admit the mistakes. He should resign and go on. That hasn't happened. But let's be clear, a terrible thing I'm seeing in Washington is no one wants to step up and say, okay, I made the mistake, I'm responsible for what happened here. And I think that they almost don't know how it happened to them. But it really was the State Department. You wouldn't have seen, what's my evidence? Look at that airlift, brilliantly carried out by the Air Force and the Air Mobility Command and Transcom, and by the Marines and Army forces who went in there and secured Kabul to make that happen. But this was not in anyone's plan. And you can look back at the series of events and see how far out of control this all was. So let's keep the blame where it rests, and that is with the State Department and with the Biden White House's decisions in April to abandon the plan and to let NATO leave as well. Dale, you know, NATO has been part of the Afghanistan mission a long time, both the individual countries and then NATO as an alliance itself. And they had actually funded to keep NATO forces in Afghanistan through the year 2024. But in April, when the Biden White House said, hey, we're going to leave, they put pressure on NATO to leave as well, along with the large number of contractors who were maintaining planes and doing the other jobs that they do. So this really was this initiative there. I think at some point, I think there was a misunderstanding of the situation on the ground on the part of the White House. I think they were briefed that to go back in would take numerous brigade combat teams, would take 10, 15,000 soldiers to do that. I don't think that that really represented all the options that were there. But at any rate, it was just fumbled over and over again. But be clear, it really was a Washington State Department, National Security Council, and White House set of decisions. Mm-hmm. That's where the blame comes down to. Those are the folks in charge. They're the ones who made these decisions, and it's their fault.
It would be nice if somebody would step forward, as you mentioned, and acknowledge that, you know, yep, we did it, and, you know, maybe make an apology to those 800,000 veterans that did serve in Afghanistan. So what's going to fill the void? Do you see the Taliban as just returning to the way that they were, or do you see some outside influences jumping in?
Here's the other crazy part of that story, and that is the whitewashing of the Taliban. The president has talked from the beginning about the Taliban needing economic aid, about the conditions for the legitimacy of the Taliban state. And I'm stunned because there was a democratically elected government with a constitution in Afghanistan. And we just let that go. A sovereign nation, boom. No one's even talking about it anymore. So there's a whitewashing of the Taliban that's going on. I think what we're going to see next is a few things. One, the airport in Kabul has reopened, partly because it was left in pretty good shape and we left behind quite a bit of equipment, firefighting equipment, all the stuff you need to run an airport. They got that running again pretty quickly, and we are already seeing that there is a food crisis in Afghanistan and the beginnings of the UN and others talking about supplying aid. I believe the U.S. is down for $64 million worth of aid to Afghanistan's Taliban government. Crazy, right?
Yep.
But again, with this very media-savvy, very different Taliban, I think the Taliban want to be recognized as a legitimate state. They're also great negotiators, and they've said, well, if the United States isn't going to help us, we'll just get our aid from China. Mm-hmm. Now, China has already been in there. There was talk about Afghanistan's very valuable copper mine. China has actually had the lease on that mine since the year 2007. They've had a hard time running it because of the situation in the country, but they've already got the lease there. And I think Russia will be happy to help out because, oddly, Russia and China, who, of course, have borders, right, they want a peaceful Afghanistan. And I think the long-term plan did envision that the Taliban would become legitimate participants in Afghanistan's political process, in the government, but with an elected government. This takeover was not what anybody pictured. So the Taliban are going to try to go legit, but of course they are going to continue to carry out anything they feel like doing. We heard some odd reports about bickering between the Haqqani network and other elements of the Taliban. So what we really have there is a very unpredictable state that is a magnet for terrorists, where you can set up anything that you want in terms of terror activities, I imagine, and a state that is no good at governing. They're great at, you know, running around and controlling people like the mafia, right, out in the cities and provinces, but they're not really set up to be an international government. It's just beyond disgraceful that we're even discussing things like aid to the Taliban after they took over Afghanistan. It's crazy.
I know, but you know, the sad part is that you have the Afghan populace that are going to be suffering from the lack of food and so on and so forth that goes along with that. And I was just thinking about, you know, how tribal that that part of the world is, and that there's going to be, you know, they're going to have difficulty controlling Afghanistan just like anybody else would, because there's all these different factions throughout their countryside.
That's right. And of course, one of the major powers in Afghanistan is and always has been Pakistan. So Pakistan, under the Prime Minister Imran Khan, was a participant in this now sort of defunct, derailed peace process, and happy to help with security guarantees. But at this stage, it's just completely unpredictable. And we've seen the troubles on the border. And then that's on the one side. Back on the other side, you have Iran, which has a nearly 500-mile border with Afghanistan. There have been elements of Iranian forces in and out of that region for a long time. So it really is just a huge question as to how bad it's going to be. But I think that, you know, I feel like the Biden administration now wants to see the Taliban succeed and go legit and succeed in governing the country. It's preposterous. What would have worked was the original plan under the 2020 peace deal, which was to convince the Afghan government to let the Taliban have some elected representatives within a mixed government. That was really where this was heading. That probably would have worked. Mm-hmm. I don't think this is going to work very well. And the stain on the decision-making, you know, really as a strategist, you say, you saw the U.S. lose initiative and then time after time after time fail to get the ball back, you know, to use a football analogy. I think one of the key moments certainly was when the Taliban got to the outskirts of Kabul. They sent a team in to the presidential palace, kicked out Ghani, but the rest of the Taliban stayed outside the city for about 48 hours. There was the opportunity for the U.S. military to say, wait, don't go one step further, because this was still a bunch of guys, some of whom didn't have shoes and, you know, right, their AK-47s. So to see the loss of initiative, that's why I say I really implicate the State Department here, because, you know, there just no one appeared to be able to think that they could do anything in this process other than go to their default evacuation order plan, which is what they did. That's when the prison got opened up, all this. So this inability of this U.S. administration to take military initiative is the thing that I think it really stunned and worried our allies around the world and has made countries like China very bold and gloating over this. And I continue to see this even with our Afghanistan policy. We don't seem to have gotten the initiative back at any point in the last 6 weeks.
No, I'm just, you know, I was thinking about all the military people that I've ever talked to, especially the generals and so forth, that they, you know, they, the war colleges and everything, they always have all these contingency plans for everything, it seems like, but nobody was listening to any of the contingency plans that they had. I'm sure that they must have had some plan to evacuate, you know, Afghanistan if it got to this point, but it didn't seem as though they were following through on anything, as you mentioned.
And here again, why it's the policy failure. When the commander-in-chief, you know, President Biden, is saying, I want to pull out and I don't care about anything else, and I'm going to keep to that August 31st date, you know, you can go brief him how many times, and if the commander-in-chief says, I don't want to hear it, no, 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 the State Department won't have anything to do with it, then you just stop briefing those plans, right? And, you know, I don't know that that's what happened, but certainly one can imagine that. And let's just take that August 31 date. There was no need to hold to that date. I mean, really, what was, you know, the decision should have been, hey, we'll leave when we're ready. We're going to stay here. We got the airport running. We're going to take people out, and it might take us a week longer. It might take us 2 months. So many different ways to do it. But when you have your, you know, you've got a team with the Biden administration that were all more junior players under the Obama mm-hmm. administration. And for some reason, they're a group that's known each other very well. Secretary of State was a staffer for the Senate when Joe Biden was there, and then he worked for him as VP. They're the director of national intelligence is a lawyer who ran a bookshop in Baltimore for a while. But they've been together a long time. This is true of the National Security Advisor, Jake Sullivan, and the others. And even Secretary of Defense Austin, who is former general, of course, was in charge of Central Command during the Obama years, and so he knew this group pretty well. Put him a little, he's in a different category. But the civilian group are a very, very tight-knit bunch, but without a lot of experience of taking military action during a crisis. Nor do most of them even come from a business background where, oh my gosh, you got to make decisions, right?
Right.
And this crisis just caught them all at their worst. But sadly, we are really going to pay a price. And I think the main price we pay is now, how do we prove that the U.S. can take that global leadership role again? I mean, if you are an ally, if you're Taiwan, right, you've right. really got to be wondering what would happen. If you're, Ukraine or Estonia, you got to wonder, oh my gosh, if I get in trouble, what will the United States
do? Who's going to come? Who's
going to
come and rescue me now? I'm going to take a real quick break here, and then we'll come right back. We're talking with Dr. Rebecca Grant about what's going on in the world. The first half of the program, we've been talking about Afghanistan and what could have, should have been done, but unfortunately was not. And the second part I want to talk about, how do we rebuild America's reputation? So you're listening to Veterans Radio. We will be right back.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them.
Sergeant First Class Paul Smith gave his life to protect his troops. Details after this.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
On April 4th, 2003, a call went out for a place to put some Iraqi prisoners. Sergeant First Class Paul Smith volunteered to create a holding pen inside a walled courtyard. Soon, Iraqi soldiers, numbering perhaps 100, opened fire on Smith's position. Smith was accompanied by 16 men. Smith called for a Bradley, a tank-like vehicle with a rapid-fire cannon. It arrived and opened up on the Iraqis. The enemy could not advance so long as the Bradley was in position. But then, in a move that baffled and angered Smith's men, the Bradley left. Smith's men, some of whom were wounded, were suddenly vulnerable. Smith could have justifiably ordered his men to withdraw. Smith rejected that option, thinking that abandoning the courtyard would jeopardize about 100 GIs outside, including medics at an aid station. He manned a 50 caliber machine gun atop an abandoned armored personnel carrier and fought off the Iraqis, going through several boxes of ammunition. As the battle wound down, Smith was hit in the head. He died before he could be evacuated from the scene.
The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
Military veterans touch everyone's life. I'm guessing right now you're thinking of a veteran, a close friend, relative. Maybe it's you. Even the toughest of us sometimes need help, but don't know where to turn for support. You don't need special training to help a veteran in your life. We can all help someone going through a difficult time. Learn how you can be there for veterans. Visit veteranscrisisline.net. Veteranscrisisline.net. A message from the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs.
We're back now with Dr. Rebecca Grant, a national security analyst out of Washington, D.C. She runs her own organization, the IRS Independent Research. And so she's been helping us figure out what's going on in the world as far as American foreign policy is concerned. So, Dr. Grant, you mentioned earlier on that, you know, you felt that China and Russia would probably move into Afghanistan. What are they doing outside of that area?
Well, China and Russia are active as always. Let's just cover Russia for a moment. They held their big war games recently, and, you know, they have continued to be the eager aggrandizers that they are. Interesting point, though, you know, what happened to Vladimir Putin, who is their leader?
Yes.
He got exposed to COVID and is self-isolating for 2 weeks.
Couldn't happen.
That shows you that their vaccine, which they called Sputnik, their Sputnik vaccine, Maybe didn't do what it was supposed to. In case. He doesn't really have it. He's just been exposed.
Couldn't happen to a nicer guy.
Right. It couldn't happen to a nicer guy, exactly. And one thing Putin has done a lot in the last couple of years is participate in war games with China. China and Russia have had a military relationship for a long time, but it's been a little bit cool. You know, China has stolen as much technology from Russia as they have from us, I think.
Right.
Not quite as good, but they've stolen quite a bit. But what we've been seeing over the last 18 months is an escalation of their joint military operations. We've seen bomber flights together. We've seen joint exercises of all types. You know, it's really to the point where you have to consider them as a potential combined threat. That serves the political purposes for both of them, but that deepening cooperation is really, really scary. And even without cooperation with Russia, China would be plenty scary on its own. So many reasons, so many things I want to talk about, including Taiwan and their buildup in their nuclear program.
Okay, so let's talk about Taiwan first of all.
Right, and Taiwan, so sad. You know, China's had its eye on Taiwan for forever. Over the last couple of years, the United States has greenlighted sales of defensive military equipment to Taiwan, which was long overdue. This includes F-16 fighters, MQ-9 Reaper drones, and a number of missile systems, air defense missiles and others, that are really essential for the defense of Taiwan. This is great, really needed to be done, but of course, it just drives China bananas to see this happening. And then on top of this came the fall of Kabul, and China was out within hours really laying it on the line, and China says, hey, that's an omen for what will happen to you. The fall of Kabul proves that U.S. military power is at an end and that allies cannot trust the United States. This was pointed directly to Taiwan and said, basically, the fall of Kabul means that the United States will not live up to its obligations to Taiwan to defend Taiwan. Wow. I mean, they wasted no time in coming out with this. But it's really worrying. You know, Taiwan is trying to make itself sort of what they call a sea fortress. And they've got a great president, President Tsai. She is a new generation of politician in Taiwan, very popular. Of course, the economy in Taiwan is very interlinked with China's. But we really have, I think, a big test here in the U.S. as to how much we want to be clear that we will defend Taiwan. And believe me, we have to. We have got to make sure that China does not think they can walk in and take over. Two scenarios. The scenario that's been around a long time is that China launches an amphibious invasion across the strait, lands at a bunch of points, maybe conducts a little air campaign, and they take over. Our military planners have been working on that one for decades. But I think that after the fall of Kabul, we see another possibility, and that is to whether China might like to try a decapitation strike. You know, Dale, China's Air Force has a special test range where they have a mock-up target of Taiwan's presidential palace, and they practice their bombing on that.
Really?
China, can you believe? I mean,
no,
I believe, right?
I believe it. I mean, I do. I believe it, but geez. Oh, man.
I know. And now Taiwan has a pretty strong self-defense. I mean, that place is bristling with guns, okay? Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, China has no combat experience. The Chinese haven't fought a big war since Korea. You know, whereas obviously they fought a lot in the Korean War in 1950-1953. They very unpleasant skirmish where they killed some Indian forces up on the border last year, very worrying. Some skirmishes with Vietnam, but they have not. They do not have combat experience. So they really study every use of military force. And what's the lesson they take out of Kabul? Well, heck, why not try a decapitation strike? And so I wonder if they simply bombed a couple targets and landed some forces by airdrop on Taiwan, what would the world do? Right?
Right.
You know, that's a pretty scary question. My take on this is that in addition to the arms sales that we have ongoing, in which the Biden administration has supported, Trump started them, but Biden has supported them, that we also need to add some U.S. forces in Taiwan, I would say rotational forces, an outfit of Marines with their F-35s and their helicopters, or air forces that go through on a rotational basis, Army forces with missiles, a rotational training force somewhat like what we have in Poland, would make it a much more costly target and I think really help to deter the Chinese. And this is one of the big problems. Got a force that doesn't have a lot of military experience. Remember, this is a nation of kids who were their only children, right? Remember the one-child policy?
Yes. Right.
So all China's leaders, every one of them is an only child. I mean, I'm an only child. I have a much older brother. But, you know, we all used to get in our way. Right?
Yes, I know.
Imagine a group of that. So it's very, we really struggle to understand what deters China. But I'm telling you, rotational training U.S. forces on Taiwan would help a lot.
Well, let's go across the bay or across the water then to Korea. Is that what we're doing there?
Right. Well, we have 28,000 U.S. forces in Korea, Army and Air Force, and ready to fight tonight is their motto. And we actually, about 10 years ago, really expanded our presence there in and around Osan and our other big bases. And we leave those forces there as a deterrent to North Korea, and it works really well. And we don't need necessarily to have a huge force presence on Taiwan. You know, one of the tragedies of Afghanistan is we actually did a good job leaving small forces in Iraq, where we have about 2,500 American forces. There are still 900 U.S. forces in Syria. They're at one of the little bases on the border, and they're also helping to guard the Syrian oil fields. We have U.S. forces in Somalia. So we've done a good job of leaving small numbers of forces to help deter and stabilize. And I think something like that on Taiwan at this point would be very appropriate. Their symbolic value and their training value with the Taiwan forces would really cause China to think twice.
Yeah, I would think so, because I mean, personally, you know, I don't think we're ever going to see a war on the level of a World War II, where you're just, you know, constantly putting ground troops in. With the technology today, you don't need to do that.
That's right. So rotational forces and deterrent, look, neither China nor the U.S. want to go to war with each other. We don't want to see a war over Taiwan. Taiwan's doing great. One of the 20th largest economy in the world, I think. They're doing a terrific job. Place is in great shape. But we need to be able to deter. And it's sometimes as simple as putting some of those forces in the right place until the Chinese come to their senses. And I don't want to leave China without telling your listeners about their nuclear program.
Okay. So what are they up to now with that?
Right. First, there's the virus, the COVID, the military. But okay, so in August, they unveiled, probably on purpose, an entirely new ICBM, intercontinental ballistic missile field, 200 new silos for their nuclear missiles that are going to be aimed at us. And here's the scary thing, you know, Dale, China does not do arms control. There's not a treaty. I think they belong to the non-proliferation treaty, but that's it. And they adamantly refuse to get into any arms control about nuclear weapons. So that means they can put 200 new missiles in the ground, but each of those missiles can have multiple warheads. Remember the term MIRV, multiple independent, reentry vehicle. Old term, right? But it means multiple warheads on one missile. That's arms controlled between the U.S. and Russia, but not China, because they don't do arms control. So 200 silos, but 2,000 warheads if they want. Really bad. And what I think is really scary about this, and Admiral Richard at Strategic Command talked about this again this week, is it's the pace that they're building. We are refurbishing our Minuteman missiles and building a new deterrent. We expect to have those missiles in the ground by about 2030, 2035. Whoa. China looks on track to complete their 200 new silos with missiles in about 3 to 4 years. Why? They don't need these. They do not need these. They've typically kept a very small nuclear deterrent. So why in the heck did they suddenly need 200 new intercontinental missiles and maybe 2,000 warheads? They've opened up a third facility for producing nuclear material, weapons material. They're just scary. Scary, scary, scary.
Well, very scary. I mean, you know, so many people and such a large military program going on over there that, it seems like we have to we just have to continue to trying to keep up. It's like, you know, everybody is trying to stay one step ahead, and so we end up putting so much money into our military budgets.
That's right, in trying to keep up, and we already know that we are either not as far ahead as we want to be or, you know, slightly off the pace in areas like hypersonics. China's also really gone full steam ahead in their drone development. And, you know, what's the purpose of all this? Well, the military purpose is to try to lock the United States out of that half of the Pacific, mm-hmm. which we don't want to let happen. Luckily, we have our tremendous allies, India, Japan, Taiwan, South Korea, Australia. And there's some news about Australia. But back to China for a minute. Why are they doing this? Well, the thing that China wants more than anything is to stay in power. It's pretty tough. They have to block out the internet. They have to tamp down a long history, a historical legacy of factionalism. And they have this bankrupt communist ideology. So building up a military and amplifying world threats, of course, is a way to keep power domestically. Mm-hmm. That's part of why they're doing it. But very, very scary. And because we don't understand as well how to deter them, it is really a really scary situation to see their nuclear modernization. And that's led Australia to make an interesting decision.
Okay, yeah, we were just going to go to Australia. So this was just this week, wasn't it?
Yes, just this week, Australia's Prime Minister Scott Morrison, along with Boris Johnson of the United Kingdom and President Biden here, announced that Australia will build nuclear-powered submarines. They're going to build 12 nuclear-powered submarines with U.S. help. Really significant. Why is Britain in this? Well, of course, the United States and Britain have a long-standing mutual program for building nuclear-powered submarines. They're now admitting Australia to this group. Huge, and it's a wonderful step forward. Australia is such a key ally. And Australia always takes the brunt of whatever China unleashes. There have been trade wars. There have been military threats. You know, Australia was one of the first to call out China's military threat almost 15 years ago. And they've been a tremendous staunch ally. You just look at a map of that region and you see why Australia is so important. Australia has done well economically over the past decade or so, and they've spent a lot of that money on building up a really first-class military, a terrific air force. And now we see their investment in the nuclear-powered submarines. A lot of the conflict with China will be a naval conflict and maritime-based, and that undersea supremacy is absolutely vital. It's terrific to have Australia, such an important ally, now fully invested in this nuclear program. Sadly, France was unhappy because they were going to buy ships from France, but now they're not. And, of course, China was furious to learn that Australia would be building 12 nuclear-powered submarines with American and British help. It's great. It's probably the best news this week, is this great building up of our partnership with Australia.
Well, I know that they've been so supportive of whatever America has done over the years. I mean, I worked with Australian troops when I was in Vietnam, and they were excellent. They were just great men and women. We've talked about Australia and kind of circling around China just to, you know, maintain this sort of protective barrier between whatever their goals are and whatever our goals are. What do you think our goals are, if I could ask that question right now?
Well, you hit the nail on the head. The number one goal is that protective barrier, our alliances. You know, China does not have allies, okay? Well, they have Russia. but we have tremendous allies. And, you know, China's bad behavior with trade and military operations and COVID and you name it has really strengthened these alliances, and they are what will get us through. You know, there are two particular forms. One is what they call the Five Eyes of Australia and the UK and us and New Zealand. And then there's also what they call the Quad, which involves Japan and India and South Korea as well. So you really almost do have a circle here. And it's these alliances that are going to be key. And that's why I'm just so glad to see this expanded cooperation with Australia. So, you know, that is what we want. It's through our alliances also that we start to repair some of the damage from Kabul.
Right.
The Australians were in Afghanistan from the first minute.
Right, yeah.
With their special forces. And right up till the last minute. And, you know, that those bonds are incredibly important. And so, you know, we have to kind of process through the terrible mistakes that we made, the terrible screw-ups.
Mm-hmm.
Of the last few weeks with Afghanistan, and through these alliances and our exercises, our mutual programs, all that. We do even more with Australia. We have a big hypersonics program with them, and our forces rotate there quite frequently. We often see our B-52 bombers exercising out of Australia, and of course, huge naval connections with all their ports, Perth and others. So we want, first of all, to maintain our alliances, and secondly, you know, we want to contain China. You know, that's the long-term goal. We don't hear as much about it. The real concern here is, again, whether this administration will be able to look that square in the eye. They tend to want to back off a little and say, well, we don't want to fight. We want to cooperate. We want to get together on climate change and do international things. But, hey, I mean, we're just past all that. China is really, truly aggressive. They make no secret about it. And so it's, you know, our top policy priority needs to be strengthening our allies in that region.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. We're talking with Dr. Rebecca Grant, who is our Veterans Radio own national security expert, who's been on our program. I can't even count the number of times, but almost over a 10-year time period. I want to address a question about the... I'm looking at India. And I'm curious about India, you know, on the border with China and, you know, another billion people. And, you know, and of course, they're on the border with Pakistan as well. So do you see any connection between all these countries?
Well, you know, we've worked for the last decade, really, to improve our relationship with India. I believe, you know, President Obama visited, and so did President Trump, because, you know, India is really quite crucial there. Now, you know, they have their issues with Pakistan, shall we say, that's putting it lightly. They have territorial disputes. India is a nuclear power, so is Pakistan. We used to worry quite a bit about potential problems there. They have a heavily armed border, and they look at each other and, you know, and really, even down to Afghanistan policy, there's been some back and forth and feuding and fighting. So we expect to see that with India and Pakistan. It's a fallout of the way that the British divested their interest in that area and left two states that really, really didn't get along. But as far as U.S. relations with India, they've been very strong. We have pretty good defense cooperation there. We sell them certain systems. We'd like to sell them more, but they do buy some. And I think we see now, because of the terrible incident that took place last year on the Indian border, where Chinese troops killed and then apparently mutilated about 20 Indian military forces during a border dispute. And this, I mean, it was just a little bit reported, but then I think so much else happened that we lost sight of it. This was really bad, and it really ruined any sort of lingering flame of cooperation between China and India. So, you know, I think India is really a bright spot for U.S. foreign relations and really for the world in that area.
Well, I would think so. I want to end this up with you. Bob Woodward's come out with another book. And, you know, the what is it, Admiral Milley? Is that his name?
General.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, the general. You know, supposedly making secret calls and so forth to China and people, you know, the news media people are going crazy over this. And I was wondering if you could, as you put in your note to me, can we unpack the facts on that?
Right. Let's start with Woodward, who was so famous and from the Watergate investigations of so very long ago. But, you know, his last three books have been titled Rage, Peril, and Fear.
Right, yeah.
So that would tell you kind of the market he's going for at this point. And one just has to take Woodward with a grain of salt, because sometimes I think the military facts get taken out of context. Milley has not covered himself in glory this summer with Afghanistan and with his sort of very bumbling attempt to address critical race theory in the military. So Milley can be a bit of a chowderhead, all right? But having said that, the fact is that there is a U.S.-China strategic dialogue mechanism, which involves the chairman calling up his counterpart. Milley's the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. It's been going on since 2017. Obama started it. Trump actually put it into action. Milley's predecessor, General Dunford, made several calls. We want the chairman to call up his Chinese counterpart regularly and, you know, trash talk him a little and just keep the communication there. Because, as I said earlier, it's very hard to understand the Chinese. They're not a combat experienced force. Deterring them is tough. You want that line of communication. Okay, don't freak out. The chairman also calls his Russian counterpart regularly. That's General Gerasimov, who's a bit of a goon, okay? He came to the, you know, the Geneva summit, always, he's always there with Putin. They talk regularly as well. And it's something that, again, we want that to happen. That's an outgrowth of the much longer hotline between Washington and Moscow that used to be this little red.
Right, the red phone,
back
right.
In the command center. So this is normal stuff. And you've got to remember, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, it's a staff job. He is not in the military chain of command. The chain of command goes from the president to the Secretary of Defense to the combatant commanders. If that's nuclear weapons, which came up this week, that goes to a strategic command. So Milley can say or do anything he wants, and he is just not in the chain of command for nuclear weapons. There is a little office at the Pentagon, the National Military Command Center, that has to authenticate that it's the president calling and giving orders in order to initiate a nuclear war. They rehearse that all the time, like you practice everything. But then that command goes to STRATCOM, Admiral Richard, who executes that. So a lot of this tempest was just some here. We don't even know if this stuff is true in Woodward's book, because he always anonymously sources. So it sounds awful. As I said, Milley has not been covering himself in glory. I'm not a big fan of his this week. But some of the military facts here are really, really off. And, you know, I worry that this is another attempt to distract from the situation in Afghanistan and possibly to set up Milley to take some of the fall for this. So who knows? I mean, I've been disappointed in some things Milley has said and done, but the facts in this case have really got distorted by the Woodward book.
Wow. There's always stuff. There's always stuff out there that thankfully we have you to go to and say, what is really happening here? Is there anything else that you would like to discuss today?
Oh, I've just so enjoyed talking with you. I did want to just give a quick comment on North Korea.
Okay.
They have done a couple of short range tests, but I don't have to say, so far they are holding to their word about not testing any long-range missiles or more nuclear weapons. So that's a little bit of a good thing, I would say. But and I would just say again, let's go back to Afghanistan. You know, I just want to send out my thanks, and you as well, I know, have done this already, to those 800,000 U.S. service members, men and women who served in Afghanistan. I think it really did help keep America safer. I have no doubt about that. And my heart breaks for everyone watching this. It's been hard for me as an analyst to watch what's going on. I can't even imagine for those who were there, those who lost friends there. And also, you know, it's up to our military to help just bit by bit and relationship by relationship to repair our U.S. world leadership role. And the best people to do this now are tremendous U.S. servicemen and women. You've got it. Take it away.
Okay. Awesome. Thank you, Dr. Rebecca Grant, for being on Veterans Radio again. We'll check in again in another quarter or so to make sure we can find out what's really going on in the world.
Thank you, Dale.
That was Dr. Rebecca Grant. We hope you enjoyed that interview. We hope you enjoyed the program today, and maybe we actually learned something new. I know I did. So thanks very much for listening. We hope that you'll tune in again next week. If you have a story idea you'd like us to share or take a look at, you can go to veteransradio.net and just click on the Contact Us and give us your idea. Next week is our monthly benefits program, and that will be broadcast live from 5 to 6 p.m. Eastern on our website. You'll be able to find it right there. And if you have a question about the VA healthcare system or a disability claim or anything along those lines, you can just, again, go to that same Contact Us button, or you can email me at dale@veteransradio.net. Oh, before I forget, you can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. Please sign up and join our mailing list so you'll always know what's going on Veterans Radio. So until next week, this is Dale Thronberry thanking you for listening to our program. And until then, you are dismissed.